All right. Good morning, everybody. Guys, my name is Kenny. I get to pastor our central family downtown. It's really good to get to be with you. I'm glad that you're here today. So if you're joining us online this morning, if you're just kind of catching up with us, maybe a little bit later on in the week, maybe you're at one of our greater Austin area campuses. Buda, I want to shout out to you this morning. I know you're with us. We got Dripping Springs with us this morning. Our friends in Gateway Branson. All of our friends joining us around the world online. Maybe you're here with us in the room. Let's hear it for North Campus this morning. It's good to be together. And I don't know why I say this, but especially my students in the house this morning. Glad that you guys are here. It's good to be together. And I just want to say that as we continue in this healthy spirituality series, we want you to remember that Gateway is a come-as-you-are church. And so I'm very aware of the fact this morning that I have friends here in our community who are exploring faith, just kind of exploring who God is and what it means to be a part of the church. And we really hope that this gives you an opportunity from your perspective to just to engage with God in a whole new way, to grow in your faith. Maybe you've been kind of overwhelmed. Maybe you're feeling a little tired lately and ready for something new in your life, and this could be a great start. This is just designed for you to have some new practices in your life to help you get and stay healthy spiritually. Does that sound okay? Ooh, tough room this morning. Okay, that's okay. I got some work cut out for me this morning. That's okay. Now, you remember that a couple weeks ago, Carlos started us off in this series talking to us about following the Spirit in our lives. Last week, Eric was here, and he was talking to us about what it's like to read the Bible, but also to apply that to our lives every day. And this morning, we're going to apply what we've learned so far to living in intentional community together. And just like the weeks prior, we're going to start off with a video to get us started. So let's check this out.
There's this beautiful poem. It's in the book of Isaiah.
The city of Jerusalem has just been destroyed by Babylon, a great kingdom in the north. And all of these Jewish people, they've been sent away into exile, but a few remained in the city. And they're left wondering, what just happened? Has our God abandoned us?
Right, because Jerusalem was supposed to be the city where God would reign over the world to bring peace and blessing to everyone.
Now, Isaiah had been saying that Jerusalem's destruction was a mess of Israel's own making. They had turned away from their God, become corrupt, and so their city and their temple were destroyed.
Yeah, everything seems lost.
But the poem goes on. There's a watchman on the city walls, and far out on the hills, we see a messenger, and he's running towards the city. He's running, and he's shouting, "Good news!" And Isaiah says, "How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news."
Beautiful feet?
Yes. The feet are beautiful because they're carrying a beautiful message.
What's the message?
That despite Jerusalem's destruction, Israel's God still reigns as king, and that God himself is going to one day return to this city, take up his throne, and bring peace.
And the watchmen sing for joy because of the good news that their God still reigns.
Now, in the New Testament, we find this same phrase, the good news. It's the Greek word euangelion, and it's also sometimes translated with the word gospel.
Yeah, so when Christians say, "Do you believe the gospel?" they mean, "Do you believe the news?"
But not just any news. In the Bible, this phrase is always about the announcement of the reign of a new king. And in the New Testament, the Gospels use this phrase to summarize all of Jesus' teachings. They say that he went about proclaiming the good news of God's kingdom.
So Jesus saw himself as the messenger, bringing the news that God reigns.
Yes, but the way that he described God's reign, it surprised everybody. I mean, think, a powerful, successful kingdom. It needs to be strong, able to impose its will, able to defeat its enemies. But Jesus said the greatest person in God's kingdom was the weakest, the one who loves and who serves the poor. And he said that you live under God's reign when you respond to evil by loving your enemies and forgiving them and seeking peace. This is an upside-down kingdom.
Now, Jesus also said that this kingdom was arriving with him.
Yeah, so for example, there's this really interesting story where there's a high-ranking Roman officer, and he comes to Jesus begging him to heal his servant. And he even calls Jesus his Lord, acknowledging that Jesus is his authority. Jesus praises this man for recognizing what no one else yet had, that not only was Jesus announcing God's kingdom, he was the king.
And so the word gets out that this Jewish man from Galilee is talking and acting like he's the king of Israel. He's appointing 12 disciples, which are an image of Israel's 12 tribes. He's healing people, forgiving people their sins.
And all of this so threatened Israel's leaders that they finally decide to have him killed. And Jesus let them.
Yeah, which is a weird thing to do if you're trying to become king.
That's right. But for Jesus, this is what had to happen. Jesus saw the sin and the devastation of his people Israel as just one small part of the entire human condition. How all humanity has rebelled against God, resulting in the tragedy and devastation of our whole world. So how is God going to bring his reign over such a world? Jesus believed it would be through an act of sacrificial love for his enemies. This is why in the Gospels, Jesus' crucifixion is depicted as his enthronement as the king of the Jews.
Yeah, he receives a crown. He also receives a robe.
He's exalted up, not onto a throne, but onto the cross.
How beautiful are the feet that bring good news.
And the good news now is that Jesus has defeated death and that he reigns as king, that he's dealt with our sin and corruption himself and that he's conquered it with his life and with his love.
And then Jesus sends his followers to go out and keep announcing this good news of the upside down kingdom.
And to invite everyone to give their allegiance to him, the king who defeated death with his love.
Good. Yeah, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. And friends, this morning, that's my hope. My hope is to bring some good news. In fact, if you don't know me, I'm very ADHD, Kevin knows, and I can tend to get off track really easily and stuff. So some questions like you might wanna just be asking pretty regularly through this message just to keep on track is okay, then who is this good news really for, right? And what does it look like to live in community? What does community actually look like? Just to help me stay on track, we'll keep asking those questions because I feel like the best place for us to start if we want to understand creating and living in community is to actually ask, well, how did Jesus do it? And it seems to me that when we think of Jesus in community, it seems to start at a table. Now, when you picture that table in your head right now, it probably doesn't look like much to you. It's a table, right? It's not certainly not anything real revolutionary, but historically, the table has been very loaded with meaning. The table where people would gather would be a place where questions like who's in and who's out would be answered. It asked the question, who's accepted and who's not acceptable? The place may be a place of very warm invitation for some and very cold rejection to others. And it's a place where for centuries, marginalized people have been asking, do I have a seat at this table? And if not, how do I get one? In Jesus' day, back in the first century, this was something of a battleground, in fact. The table would have looked a lot different then, of course. Like, I know when we think of sitting around a table and eating a meal together, you might picture something a little bit like this. Some of my friends at Central Campus just hanging out, having some barbecue after a service one night. That's a great picture of a table. Or if you're fortunate enough to be invited over to my friend Shah Mahmood's house, the table might look a little different. You might see a table that sits on the floor like that with an incredible spread just like that one. But in Jesus' day, you would have been very low to the ground at this particular table. It would have probably been more of a kind of a U-shaped table. And you didn't so much sit at the table as much as you reclined at the table, right? You would recline with your feet behind you and you'd sit on that left elbow of yours so that you could eat with your right hand because, of course, your left hand was used for other things, but that's another sermon for another day, so we'll go past that. But I want you to remember from the video that we just watched that in the Old Testament scriptures, we're told a story about how Jerusalem was destroyed by the kingdom of Babylon and how most of the Jewish people were sent away in exile. The few that stayed and remained in the city were under Babylonian rule. Hundreds of years later, you jump forward and you find that the New Testament, you find that the Romans were now in power over Israel. And so the question that haunted so many of the Jewish people was, how did this happen again? How did we get here? And some of the Jews were pushing in those days for armed revolt. Probably wouldn't have been a great idea against the Roman Empire. But there were other ones who were just kind of like, look, if you can't beat them, join them, right? And they just kind of got in bed with them politically or went into business with them and started working for them. But there was another group, a group who was really the most zealous about religion. And they had a different take on what was going on. They were advocating that the problem with the Romans was not so much a military problem, but it was a spiritual problem. Many of them believed that the reason that the Roman Empire was occupying Israel was because the Jewish people were not holy or godly enough. This group was called the Pharisees. Maybe you've heard of them before. And so to fix this problem with the Romans, the Pharisees, they took the more than 600 some odd laws and commands from the Hebrew scriptures, intensified those laws, kind of amped them up and started to enforce them very heavy-handedly on everyone. Even the laws that applied to how priests were supposed to get clean and supposed to eat sacrifices in the temple, all kinds of stuff like that, and that's what the people were dealing with. So you see, friends, in that day, the table had become a place of profound meaning because in Jesus' day, who you ate with showed who you accepted and who you rejected. In Jesus' day, it showed who you deemed clean or unclean. If you shared a meal with someone, it said that you accepted them and you saw them as equal in status because they were your community. You with me? So the Pharisees taught that if you ate with someone, that would make you religiously unclean. If they were unclean and you ate with someone, that would make you unclean. So as you can imagine, one of their pet peeves was that you never ate with sinners. You never ate with those people. You never ate with people who were unclean. Why? Well, because we're trying to prove to God how holy and righteous we are in hopes that God's gonna finally come and he's gonna wipe out the Romans once and for all. So that's what's happening. And you say, yeah, that's great, but Kenny, what does this have to do with good news and living in community? And that's a great question, and I'm so glad you asked, because Mark, in the New Testament, tells us a story. This is in Mark chapter 2, and Mark begins by saying, once again, Jesus went out beside the lake, a large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. He walked along, and he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at a tax collector's booth. Very interesting. So let's stop for just a second, because if you're new to the Bible, you got to kind of understand something about tax collectors. In those days, what a tax collector was it was a Jewish person who was now working with the Roman Empire, collecting taxes for Rome. And in doing so, they weren't just charging the price that the Romans were charging for that tax, but they also had been given some room to like jack the price to whatever they wanted it to be. So basically, Rome would say, this is how much money you're supposed to collect for us, but you can charge whatever you want. Anything you make on top of that goes in your pocket. So they might be charging double or triple that tax, and they're pocketing the money from their own people. So again, you have to understand, this is why tax collectors were so very despised in those days. And again, Jesus comes up to this guy who's collecting money and literally stealing from people. And what does Jesus say to him? Of course, follow me. Follow me, Jesus told him. And Levi got up and followed him. And while Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. Really interesting. Now, who do you think were the people that were willing to eat with tax collectors? Anyone? Let me give you an example. I struggled with addiction in my life for many years. Crystal meth was my drug of choice. Hold your applause. And here's the thing. And so I was what was known, at least in my community, as a tweaker, which meant that I was usually up all night, and maybe during the day I would get whatever sleep I could find. But who do you think I was hanging out with most of the time? You can say it. Other tweakers. That's right, because those are the people who are willing to kind of hang out with someone like me. So again, I ask, who do you think we're willing to eat with tax collectors? other tax collectors typically. You're with me, right? And so when Levi began to follow Jesus, this tax collector begins to follow him, and now he's associating with this rabbi who is growing in popularity. He gets excited and he invites his friends over for a party, right? He wants to show off that he's hanging out with this Jesus. And again, according to the Pharisees, Jesus should never have stepped foot in the home of a tax collector. In fact, there were other rabbis in Jesus' day that taught that if you even enter a tax collector's house, that would automatically make you unclean. And so here's Jesus eating with people thought to be the worst of the worst. And Mark goes on to tell us that when the teachers of the law, who were the Pharisees, they saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, well, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? On hearing this, Jesus said to them, it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. And I've come to call the righteous, not the righteous, but the, call the righteous, but the sinners. See, it's always really fascinating to me when I read these stories, because when you look back at the time when Jesus walked the earth, the people that were most attracted to him most of the time seemed to be the people who were marginalized, overlooked, abused by the powers that be, especially the religious establishment of the day. Very interesting. But the people who were most threatened or offended by Jesus were usually the uber religious of the day. And so this is where the table gets kind of revolutionary, friends. Because Jesus would, if he would eat with tax collectors before they even got their act together, before they had everything all figured out, then the question becomes, who would Jesus eat with today? Yeah, he would eat with those of us who don't have it all figured out. He would eat with those of us who are still in process, who don't have our act fully together. He would eat with us, wouldn't he? And you say, yeah, okay, now that's kind of good news. But what does this have to do with living in community? And that's a great question. And I'm really glad you asked, because if you're here and you don't believe in God this morning, Jesus would eat with you. If you're here and you've been judged or marginalized or rejected, Jesus would eat with you. If you have lived a life where you've been deemed either religiously or socially or culturally unacceptable in some way, Jesus would eat with you. Friends, if like me, you have carried the weight of the shame of feeling like the biggest sinner in every room that you walk into, Jesus would eat with you. And this good news is for you. And this community is for you. See, friends, this whole thing called the church, it really starts with a bunch of outcasts and screw-ups and misfits gathering around tables with Jesus and with each other. This is for you. I love that my oldest son, Levi, he's 13 this year, and you know, he's grown up a pastor's kid, and he's just kind of been a part of all the work and ministry that my wife, Jenny, and I have done. And so he's typically kind of just been the oldest kid at the things that we've started along the way. And this year, he was given this incredible opportunity to jump in here at North Campus with the Gateway students. And I've been so grateful for Isaiah and his leadership and so many of the other leaders with our students who have been loving my son and creating a community where he's been growing like never before, because he's got a really good pastor now. And I just get to be dad. And my son is growing. I see it happening right before me, because he's part of a community here at Gateway North where we tell the students that come from wherever they come from, this is for you. You know, there's another story I love where Jesus is eating again. Like, Jesus never really passes on a good meal, it looks like. But he's eating again, but this time he's eating at a Pharisee's house. Really interesting, because in the ancient Near East, you have to understand something. Mealtime came with a level of hospitality that was very customary. It was expected. You would typically do three things if you invited someone over to your home. You would offer them water to wash their feet, because of course the streets and the floors and such in those days were typically dirt. The streets were lined with human and animal waste. And so your feet, of course, were gonna be the dirtiest part of your entire body. But then you would also offer a person a kiss, typically on the cheek or maybe on the hand when they got to your house. And then you would anoint their head with olive oil. Now, again, let's picture that first century table one more time, right? Because Jesus is probably the guest of honor, I'm guessing, at this particular dinner. And Jesus is probably sitting kind of at the head of the table up there, and he's got his feet behind him as he's reclining on his elbow, and he's sitting there. Oh, wait, one more thing, squirrel. Meals were actually a lot more public than they were private. This is probably what gets Jesus in a lot of trouble, in fact, because a middle or upper middle class home wouldn't so much have a dining room as it might have something more like an atrium or maybe some kind of a courtyard attached to the home. And that courtyard would probably have at least one opening to the outside or surrounding town or whatever that you were in, where your invited guests could come in and come and sit at the table, right? Now, anyone walking by would have a pretty clear view of the gathering that could certainly watch the festivities that were going on. If you were poor, if you were disabled in some way and unable to hold a job, if you were one of the undesirable people, those people socially, you might be waiting around the outskirts of the courtyard in hopes of some scraps or some leftovers at the end of the meal. And if you're really lucky on a good night, you might get to hear some really good conversation or maybe some teaching from the religious elite. But again, only invited guests were allowed in. No one from the outside was allowed to come in and interact with the invited guests. And so that's where we pick up this story that Luke offers us in Luke chapter 7, where he says that now one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him. So he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And when a woman who had lived a sinful life in that town learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume. Okay, so the author here wants us to know something, that this woman is not just a woman who has made a couple of bad decisions. The author wants us to know that this is a person whose life has been marked with immorality in the eyes of the people in her town. More than likely, she's a prostitute, and she's probably semi-well-known. And she's here to see Jesus. Now remember, it's acceptable that she would come and get to hang outside with the rest of the undesirables, those people. But she appears to have a different plan. And the author tells us that she brought with her this alabaster jar of perfume. Kind of a weird detail, except I think it's good to note that this was a tool of her trade. In a world before deodorant and hot showers between clients, if you will, this is how she could make herself smell nice before engaging in her work. It's really important because somehow she's heard about this Jesus, or perhaps she's already experienced him in some way out in the culture, and she comes to him with the only thing that she has, and it's this jar of perfume. And Luke tells us that as she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. It's hard for us to really understand this scene and how offensive this woman's actions would have been to these religious people. Rule number one, someone from the outside never approaches someone on the inside. We got that. But she sees the feet of Jesus and how filthy that they must have been after walking all day. So she pulls up behind him, reclining at the table, and she begins to wet his feet with her tears. She lets down her hair, which would have been incredibly risque culturally, a no-no. And she begins to wipe the tears that have turned to mud on his dirty feet. And she kissed his feet and poured her perfume, all that she had, on them. Luke goes on to tell us that when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who was touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she's a sinner. And Jesus answered him, Simon, I have something to tell you. Tell me, teacher, he said. Two men owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 500 denarii, so like 500 days of wages or so, and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he canceled the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt canceled. You have judged correctly, Jesus said. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, for she loved much, but he who has been forgiven little loves little. Now, let's not miss what Jesus is doing here. How does Simon, this Pharisee, see this woman? Well, she's a sinner, right? She's inappropriate. She's unacceptable. He sees her through a religious lens, a lens of judgment. How does Simon see Jesus? Well, if he was really a prophet, he would know what kind of woman this was. So he sees Jesus as a fraud who is soft on sin. And he's inappropriate and unacceptable. And how does Jesus see this woman? He sees her as a human being who has a story. And he sees her through a lens of love and compassion. You see, friends, it's really important to know that religion is one of the best ways to hide from God. Because convincing ourselves that we've got it all together, or we've got all the right answers, or we're doing all the right things is a surefire way to convince ourselves that we don't really need God. Are you with me? In the context of Jesus' story of these two debtors, this woman loved so extravagantly because she knew she needed rescue. And now she'd found forgiveness with Jesus, not in the hands of the religious. It's an amazing story. And I know you say, yeah, but what does this have to do with the good news and living in community? It's a great question. I'm really glad that you asked, because friends, there is no sin. There is no stain. There is no thing that you've ever done in your life that should prevent you from coming to Jesus. And when you and I come stumbling in to a community that is centered on Jesus, I want you to know that the message is very simple. This is for you. This is for you. And some of you have felt judged and wounded by religion, even by church. I get that. Some of you have been told that you're too religious. Some of you have been cast out of community or been disowned by family. You've been told that you're not clean or you're not faithful enough or you don't have the right answers or you have the wrong ideas or you vote for the wrong people or whatever it is. Brothers and sisters, we have all experienced things like this to one degree or another. Man, I get that. But what we need to understand is that those experiences aren't a reflection of God's heart in any way. They're a demonstration of the brokenness of people, just like you and me. To understand God's heart, it's just as simple as this. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Now see, that's good news, yes? That's the good news. And who is this good news for? Well, everyone who is hungry or thirsty. All who are broken or desperate, everyone who's addicted or ashamed, everyone who is marginalized or disenfranchised, all who are mourning or whose hearts are broken today, religious, atheist, wealthy, poor, gay, straight, friends, this is for you. This is good news for you, and this community is for you. And the invitation is to come. Come and to know and to love this Jesus as we live in community together. This community is a tricky thing. It's a beautiful thing. It's something that we hold together. You know, earlier this year, John, he shared a message with our leaders across our Gateway campuses where he highlighted three key elements of creating and cultivating this healthy spiritual community together. I thought this was really valuable. John said that in intentional community, number one, there's no condemnation, right? Right out of Romans, there's no condemnation. Number two, there's no more hiding and pretending. Why? Because we don't need to. Hiding is exhausting, isn't it? Pretending, gosh, it's so exhausting. I spent most of my life living that way. But we don't need to do that anymore. Number three, we walk in authenticity. Confessional community where we tell the truth. We show up as ourselves. We even tell on ourselves sometimes. You know why? Because there's no condemnation in this community. It's okay. There's grace. That's the kind of community that we're a part of here at Gateway. Yes? And by the way, a great way for you to take a step into it, maybe practicing this in your life right now, is I would recommend checking out one of our community groups this summer. There are lots of open groups right now, and this could be a great point of connection for you over these summer months. And if you never have done so, take a step into community that way. So, in closing, you know, this is a Pentecost Sunday on the Christian calendar. You may not know that, but it's a day that commemorates the descent of the Holy Spirit on the followers of Jesus while they were in Jerusalem celebrating Pentecost together. And in Acts chapter 2, the author tells the story of the incredible things that happened that day. I recommend that you go and read it for yourself, but the author tells us of these miraculous events that led to like 3,000 people coming to faith and being baptized and starting to form these communities together. It's what many called the birth of the church. And the passage ends with the words I want to end with this morning, describing what this first church community looked like. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. And all the believers were together and had everything in common. Selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone who had need. Every day, they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes, and they ate together with glad and generous hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all people. And the Lord added to their numbers daily those who were being saved. Friends, what a beautiful snapshot of believers, new believers, living in intentional community together. More than a building, more than a sermon. It just seemed like this community centered around a table. We're gonna actually center ourselves around a table this morning. The bread and the cup, as we consider communion together this morning, because the bread and the cup that you were given on the way in, they speak a word of grace over us today. They speak a word of hope, forgiveness over us. And I want you to consider over this next song that the band has for us, what you might wanna just bring to the Lord in communion this morning, what you might wanna bring to him and just lay down maybe this morning to say, I want to lay down this stuff that gets in the way of me showing up as I really am. I want to lay down this stuff that I believe disqualifies me from community, the things that I've been told or that I've believed are the reasons why I'm not acceptable and I don't belong here and I don't have a seat at this table. God, I want to lay those things down with you today as I prepare my heart for communion this morning. Because friends, this is for you. This is for me. This is for all of us.